Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
Hello. Are we all back? Has everybody got a drink? Is everybody okay? Can we restart? Welcome back. I don't know if we mentioned this at the beginning. This is the Word in Your Ear podcast recording evening of chat, which is subsequently available as a podcast. And if you don't already subscribe to the podcast, go to wordpodcast.co.uk and you can do that. This is the last surviving sign of the late, some say, lamented Word magazine, at which one of our guests here used to work. And if you read Word, you might have got the idea that the atmosphere in the office was somewhat kind of competitive when it came to smart arsery between the various people trying to top each other and making each other laugh. And Paul played a very, very long game on the humour stakes. He didn't deal his cards readily. You know, they were generally in response to queries, and we decided actually a scientific poll established that the funniest thing ever said in the Word office. Paul used to say, he used to occasionally come in with a hangover, and people used to say, "Have you got a hangover, Paul?" He said, "Yes, I'm wearing the Iron Hat today." And then one particular day he came in looking as if he had a particularly bad hangover. And Mark said...
Are you wearing the Iron Hat,
Paul
said...
And Paul said, "There was a wide range of metal millinery arrayed around my bed when I awoke. I chose this Spanish conquistador's helmet worn at a rakish tilt."
Which meant he wasn't feeling too bad, really.
So we all took the rest of the day fictitious. Off. Then
our work is done.
People have their various kind of fictional roles on Word magazine. Mark, we used to say, was Minister for Rock, and Paul was the Secretary of State for Paul McCartney. You know, so if anything involving Paul McCartney, Paul was always the first person to get the call. And lots of that experience is reflected in his excellent new book, Conversations with McCartney, which copies are available outside, which I'm sure Paul will be very happy to autograph for you later on. Would you please welcome Paul de Noyer? And we're going to talk about Paul McCartney. And to ensure a fair fight, we've also invited along an old friend of the magazine who previously appeared on the Word podcast and also took part in a Word magazine rock quiz, which failed to win a major music industry prize recently. Paul was also a member of the team. Mark was a member of the team. I was there. Failed to win on a tiebreaker question, which Mark Allen volunteered to answer, didn't you? Said, "I know."
It was only a split second late.
And
the
we lost, Mark.
We lost by literally 0.006 of a second.
But luckily, we've forgotten all that. Yeah.
We've got over it.
But our other guest is a distinguished journalist writing all kinds of places, including The Guardian, about to publish a new book called The Music of Sadness. Will you please welcome Laura Barton? Oh, wow. Okay. So, are you
and a start? Bottle of wine. This is very nice. Bottle of wine just appeared on stage. Oh, right, yes, indeed. Well, Paul's book, which is absolutely... I wonder if this screen actually is having an effect on people's faces. It's got the Bob Dylan picture earlier on. Paul seems to have aged substantially, but anyway, it doesn't normally look like that.
That's before he's been lit by
Patrick
Woodruff.
Patrick Woodruff, that's right, yeah. But, Paul's book is... It's a terrific book, and it... It takes... there are interviews based on... I mean, when's the first time you interviewed him? When was that? Going back to what would it be, in the mid-80s?
No, the first time I met him was in 1979 in Liverpool. We did a little press conference in...
Oh, which you describe in the book. It's the enemy when you went to see Wings.
It was for the enemy, on what proved to be Wings' final tour. So that was my first meeting with Paul McCartney, and as interviews go, this was actually the worst ever in history. It was completely shambolic, and my contribution to the press conference was the worst of all. But
what was your question? Can you remember?
I can't.
You've suppressed it.
That memory. But all the other questions were of the order of, so, Paul, when are the Beatles getting back together? This was 1 year before the fateful events that night in the Dakota building. So, you know, people still did routinely ask Paul McCartney, you know, whenever they met him, you know, Paul, when are the Beatles getting back together? So the whole thing was a bit of a washout, and I was just so... Maybe we'll talk about this later, but, you know, the experience of meeting somebody like Paul McCartney for the first time is kind of...
Let's talk about that now. Go on. Meeting McCartney. What was it like, first time?
It's not like meeting... I mean, particularly if you were somebody like me of my age who'd grown up with McCartney as this phantasmagorical character, you know, who, with the other Beatles, stalks your imagination from earliest childhood. And then suddenly, by hook or by crook, you find yourself in the same room and in a position where you're expected to actually ask him a question. You haven't kind of hustled your way into his attention. You are sat there and you are expected to talk to him. And it's quite... It's unreal. There's a bit of you, like people say about the near-death experiences, you know, there's a bit of you that is actually hovering around the ceiling, looking down at yourself, talking to Paul McCartney. And the end result is you blather out some utterly, crushingly inane question about his plans for the tour or something. And but he has this fantastic capacity, and I'm by no means the only person or the first person to observe this about him, that every single person he talks to, he conveys to them the sense that they are unique, and whatever they say to him is extraordinarily interesting. It's not at all anything he's been asked a million times this month already, you know, and he has that unique, uncanny ability, which you can either read as extreme tact and sensitivity, or else as the arch manipulative plans. And that's a difficult word, and I'm sorry I even attempted it, but you know what I mean. He's either praised as being a decent kind of everyman nice guy, or else he was the canniest manipulator of the Beatles PR machine, and in a way he's a bit of both.
So, Laura, you've not met Paul McCartney.
I've not. I feel like a terrible confession of this this evening. But no, I've never met Paul McCartney.
But you must have had comparable experiences in meeting really famous people.
I mean, we were just saying there's no one as famous as Paul McCartney, really. But I was thinking about, in quick succession, I met Diana Ross, Smokey Robinson and Al Green. And it was really fascinating that none of them really wanted to talk about music whatsoever. And then, so Smokey wanted to talk about golf. And he was playing golf in this bizarre hotel room in rural Michigan. And Al wanted to talk about Jesus, and Diana wanted to talk about chicken and her favourite chicken recipe. So wasn't quite what I expected.
It's a perfect dinner party, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah.
But you just have to go along with whatever agenda they set, don't
pretty,
you?
Pretty much, yes. Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. I don't know how. My
experience with Paul McCartney was just the same as Paul's. Paul has a figure, you know, hovering above him. I always feel that there's a nutcase inside me.
Yeah.
So on the face of it, you cross your legs, you try to look really casual. You lean back, and you don't make too much of asking the question. And inside, there's this cartoon character inside you, leaping up and down, going, I'm talking to Paul McCartney. You're sort of wanting to ring everybody you know at that moment.
This is precisely
and
what
pass on that feeling, you know. And he must get a lot of that.
And deals with it brilliantly.
Yeah, because it's the idea that meeting Paul McCartney is a negotiable currency. It gives you a certain amount of kudos, doesn't it? Which you can kind of trade on. You get at dinner parties or whatever. And you say, I met Paul McCartney. Everybody's interested, aren't they?
Yeah.
And
I met him in just the end of 1982, and it was the first interview he'd done after the death of John Lennon. And as if I wasn't already wound up about the idea of meeting McCartney, my great hero, I was then given the absolute fourth degree by the PR, Bernard Doherty, who said, do not mention John Lennon. I said, obviously I won't. You know, if you mention John Lennon, he'll walk. I said, I don't understand that, you know. And this built up. It was in Air Studios, I can remember, in Oxford Street. I walked down this long corridor, and at the end of this room, in what appeared to be a throne-like chair, with his back to me, was McCartney. As I walked towards him, he turned around. And I just thought I was going to have a heart attack. And actually, your point, too, is... I grew up in a household with three elder sisters, and we just adored the Beatles. And I simply couldn't hear a word he was saying. I was just imagining that my sisters were there with me.
Noise.
Just noise. I just wanted my sisters to be there with me, and here we are. And then I got to the point where I was looking out the window, I could see people in Oxford Street. And I wanted to bang on the window and go, guys, sorry, guess what? Literally him. He's here. You know, you just get... And I was told not to mention that. When I suddenly came to, I could hear him talking about John Lennon. And he was talking about, you know, as Jen, like, he just got back from New York, and he said, as Lennon said, you know, when asked, you know, how they found America, he said, well, we turned left at Greenland, you know. He's talking about John Lennon. I'm the greatest journalist in the world. I got back to the office. They said, what did he say? And, of course, he hadn't said anything at all. I mean, all he'd done was a quote from the past, you know. And also, he is brilliantly manipulative with the press, don't you think? I interviewed one for the Radio Times, and they was doing the Queen's birthday concert at Buckingham Palace, and he just brilliantly, it was the only interview from which all the papers would have to take something. It was just brilliant at the end, described the Queen as a babe. It was just brilliant. A babe was a very voguish thing to say at the time. And it was just, you just knew, he knew that would be on the cover of the Radio Times and every newspaper. And our job was done, you know.
I don't know if anybody agrees. I've always had this theory that really photogenic people have heads that are too big for their bodies. You agree? And I think the reason for that is because we're obsessed with their heads because we've seen their faces so many times. So you're looking at them. And what you're seeing is, like, you remember those old 1940s cigarette cards of footballers? Their small bodies, enormous great heads. That's what you're seeing when you're sitting opposite Paul McCartney. It's not like sitting opposite a normal person. You're seeing this face that you've been, that's just imprinted upon you, you know? And it's a completely different experience. So how many times have you sat down with them and have had what you might call an interview?
I don't know. I guess about... 30 times or something. It's not all just formal interviews. It's occasions when we were hanging out or something. There wasn't that much socialising, but occasionally I'd go for dinners with them and things, and I've used a bit of material from that kind of thing. So I was wondering, I didn't want to get into any kind of competition with Mark Lewison or Barry Miles, because they must have... spent an awful lot of face time with him, but obviously the publishers are always trying to push you for what's the big selling point, you know? Are you actually the guy who spent more time with interviewing Paul McCartney than anybody else? And I don't know, I might be, but I would swiftly concede the palm to Mark Lewis or Barry Miles, maybe, but I'm up there anyway.
Did it help the fact that you come from Liverpool? Did that help in terms
it,
of...
Yeah, it really really did, yes. It was. I played on it shamelessly.
But one of the many fantastic things about this book is that you've talked to him in a kind of context often which isn't, as you say, an interview. So normally when people ask him questions, he's simply put on the spot and has to respond. And you get amazing revelations out of him because it's just a relaxed kind. He's been asked something he's never often been asked before and gets a real chance to think about it. Just, I have to just mention one revelation in the book, which is so brilliant, where he talks about the business of songwriting in 1960 or whatever, and says that he and John Lennon didn't have a tape recorder. So when they wrote a song, there was no way they could remember what the song was. And so they had to write a song that was so memorable. I said, well, if it's not memorable, if other people don't remember it, what's the point in writing it? So it's got to be that memorable so that we remember it.
Which is a good point. Yes, he would say that.
Now, I'd never read that, and that just came out beautifully out of a conversation with you.
Yeah, sometimes they would write a song, and then they'd get back to it with the all four the group members, and they'd say, let's do that song we wrote last night, and then, how did it go again? You know? Result can't have been that good, you know.
So in future,
we'll only play songs we can remember writing, you know. And that was a pretty good crude litmus test.
Brilliant.
So you've had this relationship with him where you know you've gone and interviewed him, and then you've been paid to do things for programs and so forth, and you know help with videos and all this kind of stuff. So does that call for a great deal of diplomacy on your part? Do you?
Yeah.
Has there occasionally been stuff he's come up with you thought, Paul, please don't do that.
I think I knew the kind of things that he wouldn't want to see in print. I had a lot more leeway when I was doing things for a magazine because, you know, we worked on big magazines, Q and Mojo and The Word, and we had sufficient power, I suppose. We could actually go back and print whatever we saw fit. And we did. But a lot of my other work for him was, I was pretty much a paid employee. I was putting together his tour programs or doing his EPKs, as they call it, electronic press kits, or sleeve notes, that kind of thing. And at which points he always had the editorial oversight. But I have to say, he hardly ever came back on anything. I'm pushed to remember anything that I ever wrote about him when he was editing it, that he came back and said, I don't want that. When he was still with Linda, during Linda's lifetime, he didn't like stuff about previous girlfriends, which is kind of humanly understandable, I suppose. There was nothing else, actually.
What about your responses to, things that he was doing? I think you mentioned in the book when he announced that he was going to put out a record called Kisses on the Bottom. I didn't know this, I'd done
the sleeve notes of this album. It was all these old vintage Broadway show tunes that he'd known as a kid, mostly, and it was called the Standards album when I was working with him on it. And then he wrote a new song called My Valentine, and it was going to be called My Valentine, and as far as I knew, that was it. Oh, it's going to be called My Valentine. And then I went to this party. He had a Christmas party. And when I went there, someone said, have we sent you a tape yet of Kisses on the Bottom? I said, sorry.
They said, turkey halfway through.
The new album, you've done the sleeve notes, you know, Kisses on the Bottom. I said, I don't think so. It's called My Valentine last time I heard. Is it? No, Paul has decided if it's called My Valentine, it'll only sell in February. He wants something that's going to sell throughout the year. He came up with something that's not going to sell throughout the year either. But I couldn't quite believe this. And I was talking to a few other people at the party and they were saying, we did our best, you know, we tried to talk him out of it. But then I talked to him and said, so, Paul, you know, interesting choice, you know, Kisses on the Bottom. And he says, yeah, well, you know, man, they all tried to talk me out of it. But, you know, they did the same when I came up with Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. You know, Paul, he said, that's not going to work, mate. You know, you've got to, you know, it's got to be, it's all happening with the Beatles or something, you know. I said, yeah, great. So I'm trying to sucking up to him, to be honest. I'm saying, yeah, great. It's like Never Mind the Bollocks or something, isn't it? He says, yeah, well, you know, I had a few other ideas in that line as well. And I'm not going to repeat them now, but they're actually they're far worse than Never Mind the Bollocks.
Kisses on the Bottom, by the way, did mean kisses on the bottom of a letter, didn't it? The little
kisses on the bottom of a letter.
But that's the thing, you're kind of double entendre as well.
I think we're just to make up.
But I suppose his point about it, he's always going to win those arguments, isn't he? Because he's always going to say, that's what they told me about She Loves You, Sgt. Pepper, whatever.
He's always got that up his sleeve. I mean, the Sgt. Pepper thing is one of his ace cars.
It was just pull Howard out. Wins every battle, doesn't
so
it?
You can see why he's a difficult man to win any kind of argument with in the studio or as a member of his band or whatever, let alone as some pitiful little journalist from the enemy. You know, you haven't got a great deal of bargaining power when it comes to playing off historical accounts against one another.
So we've done a bit of preparation. It may not seem like that, but we have. We asked our distinguished guest and ourselves to come up with our favourite Paul McCartney look. Yes, it's a long career. We decided that's not it. I'm now going to attempt to switch. Okay, Paul, you chose this. You chose the rooftop concert at Savile Row, 1969?
January 69, yeah. I thought he looked great, and I thought he looked great at that point. He never did go very far down the hippie road, and I was anticipating something Mark might say later. McCartney's dress sense was always quite reined in. He was quite small-C conservative. But he dressed very well. He was also, it goes to show, like the Abbey Road cover this fallacy that the Beatles never wanted to wear suits. It was Brian Epstein who made them wear suits. Well, Brian Epstein was dead for 2 years by this stage.
Yeah, and they all wore suits.
He'd been dead for 2 years before the Abbey Road cover. But by this time, they discovered a very good tailor, Tommy Nutter. Tommy Nutter and Edward Sexton, this tailoring team who... Edward Sexton is still going. I just thought I'm not sure about the brown shoes now that I see the full picture. But I suppose they match the Hofner base, don't they? Come to think of it.
Paul was always very much the best dressed person in the word office. Paul was the person who famously said, "Men today dress like toddlers." I've never forgotten that, which I think is a good name for a book, actually. So that's Paul's, but you might take issue with the brown shoes and the dark suit. This is yours, Laura. Yeah. You got a selection here.
Well, it's a
we've
montage.
Included a selection here.
Yeah. This is because I viewed, or the two on the left are really, because when I first encountered Paul McCartney as a young child, it was sort of a more domesticated McCartney than we might think of him in the Beatles. So when I later saw pictures of him in the sort of Beatles heyday, I was quite surprised by how clean he was, and so I like him when he's a bit fuzzy. I like how fuzzy he is around the edges at this era.
So this is kind of what 1971 or something like this, the mullet.
Yeah. I actually used to be quite scared. The first ever picture I saw of him was Red Rose Speedway, where he's got the rose in his mouth, and I found that quite terrifying as a small child. But this is how I like him, slightly.
And the cat's got a particular significance for you.
This is because I haven't interviewed or met Paul McCartney, but I did name my first cat Paul McCartney when I was...
Paul McCartney.
I love it, Paul McCartney, not just McCartney.
Not Paul.
No. I was four, and my brother and I each got a kitten. And my brother, we were allowed to name the kittens. And my brother named his after his best friend, Glenn. And I thought...
Fair enough. Who's my
I'm
best
gonna call
friend?
Mine Paul McCartney. Yeah. So I thought you might like this picture of him with a cat that doesn't look anything like my cat. But
so yeah. did you go out the back door at night with banging a dish going, Paul McCartney?
Pretty much.
Was that well?
But then he, well, you don't need to know about my cat, but he became very fat, so he became known as Fat Paul. The McCartney thing was lost after a while.
Right. Yeah. But it's an interesting point that you kind of came in at the Paul McCartney. Paul McCartney entered your life pre-Beatles, well, post-Beatles.
Yeah, so as a cat, yeah. In that sort of weird, I don't know if it's just you remember things as a child or whether it was particularly the 80s. The 80s seemed to be so full of sort of brightly coloured characters, and Paul McCartney was very much one of them to me. So, so I knew him from Sergeant Pepper. My parents listened to Sergeant Pepper a lot, and they listened to Ram, and they listened to sort of actually more the post-Beatles stuff for quite a long time. And then, obviously, Frog Chorus was a big one. So, yes. And then you lot came along with your Fab Macca and Comes Aloft.
So you'd speak in defence of the Frog Chorus, wouldn't you?
I bloody love Frog... Yeah. It was good,
Paul,
yeah.
Paul defends it rigorously in
good,
his book.
Good.
And rightly so.
Yeah.
It's good work.
I think all those... Yeah. No, I was listening to No More Lonely Nights as well on the way up here, you know. Beautiful songs. Thank you. Someone's just clapped. Thank you.
So Paul, what's your... I mean, you know, Frog Chorus, you know, it's kind
Frog
of...
Chorus,
it's an easy
yeah.
target for lazy DJs, isn't it?
It's always been an easy target for people who are just not quite as hip as they think they are, I think, which is why...
Radio DJs.
Instinctively despised that that glib dismissal of this. I mean, it was a children's song. You know, it was a children's song designed for a cartoon film about Rupert the Bear. You know, what are you expecting? A tribute to the Velvet Underground or something? It's a very efficient piece of craftsmanship for a specific task in hand, you know. Fair enough. Job done.
Absolutely fair enough. So those are Laura's looks. This is Mark's.
Oh, yeah, this is mine. Well, this picture was taken on, well, you know this. This picture was taken on the 19th of May, 1967, at Bryant's house, and it's the launch of Sgt. Pepper. And I like this because, you know, as you can see, I know a huge amount about style, but I like the fact that McCartney always looked fantastic wearing kind of Oxford bags and a kipper tie. I mean, he looked amazing in virtually anything. And in this particular picture, I always felt that the others were trying just a little bit too hard to be psychedelic. They'd probably gone to the self-named Tommy Nutter. They'd gone to some tailor who looked probably exactly like Simon D in The Italian Job, some incredibly camp guy who said, "It's all about Afghan coats now, John." You know, and I felt, you know, and psychedelic raiment, and I felt that the others were trying too hard. And McCartney in this picture here is wearing a fabulous old 1920s kind of, you know, double-breasted pinstripe, and in fact a purple t-shirt, and it just looks really good, I think. And although I have to say that the Beatles have a box set coming out at Christmas, as you probably know, and there's a video of Lady Madonna on that, which has George Harrison wearing purple corduroy shoes, so that may be actually just one louder.
I remember the corduroy shoe.
Yeah, so that's pretty good.
It was not a high point in the, you know, in the history of fashion. So that's yours. This is mine, because it's just an excuse to show the back of what I still think is probably, well, I currently think is their best record, actually. Hard Day's Night, you know. And no, it's absolutely correct, Mark. There's no point arguing about it.
This is a running theme of Word Podcast, as you know. There's no such thing as an opinion. There's any fact. It's not a debate. It's fact.
Don't embarrass yourself by trying to... But I suppose it's echoing Mark's point about the Sgt. Pepper picture. Here. Now, this is an official picture of Ringo. with the mother and father of a double chin. More than the Chinese telephone
director. You must approve that.
And John, you know, doesn't look particularly great there, and George is kind of biting his bottom lip. One person naturally knows how to have his picture taken. And, you know, to be able to project yourself in a picture is a rare skill, you know. And he has that. And I think it's mentioned in the book, actually, Paul, that lots of these pictures, that I think it was taken by Robert Freeman, weren't they, who did loads of them?
Yeah, Robert Freeman was one of the... most regular photographers, most famously, did the cover of With the Beatles, where the four heads are suspended, yes, in like half moons in the blackness. Yeah. He was one of the regular photographers. But the thing about McCartney, I always thought, was that he was, of the four, he was the one who had the right shaped head for a Beatle haircut. The Beatles, I mean, they all had identical haircuts, but they always looked best on Paul for some reason.
Yes.
It's an odd phenomenon, but there you go.
But isn't the quote in the book that, you know, people admire the way a lot of those pictures were taken early on, that the lighting was brilliant and everything. And he says, well, you know, they were just taken in a corridor with a bit of a...
The Robert Freeman with the Beatles thing was taken almost instantly, yeah, with Freeman, I think, put them in a dark corridor and pulled a curtain aside to let a chink of light through, and the whole thing is done in 20 minutes.
But I think what he says is, well, the reason we look legendary is we're pretty legendary material or something.
He would occasionally talk about that, just about how... it's an odd thing, you know, to have been that famous and photographed so many times when you were at the peak of your youth and beauty. And he obviously thinks about this a lot. He's very careful when he's being filmed. You know, it takes a long time to set up a film with him because he wants all the lighting to be, you know, as flattering as it can be. But he's not particularly vain. It's just that he's always competing with this image. You know, this man is always competing with that man. And to give him his due, actually, fair dues, we sent him a choice of pictures for the book cover. The publishers themselves were really favouring something like that, young, beautiful Paul. And he said, no, I want a really modern one that reflects me kind of talking directly, you know, to me now. So he came with what is, I think it's a lovely picture, but it's not what you would call a flattering picture.
But it's also an extraordinary...
He chose it, that's the thing, he chose it, you know.
And it's an extraordinary thing about the Beatles that they broke up when they were all, I think, you know, George was just 27, and, you know, and so that they are frozen forever in your mind as a picture of eternal youth, which has been fantastic for the group, but unbelievably difficult for him, I'm sure. As you say, every time he walks into a room, people are, their mental images of a guy in 1964 singing She Loves You. You know?
So let's talk a little bit about
you know, the key partnership in the group, and then, you know, the key relationship of his working life, John Lennon and Paul McCartney. This question has been asked loads of times. What made it work, Paul, as a relationship between the two of them?
Well, I mean, the first answer is the vaguest, and that's just that some special magic occurred, that John Lennon happened and Paul McCartney happened, and they happened to meet each other, and everything else flowed from that. It's one of those things that, you know, there's no kind of sociology that explains why that sort of thing should happen. You can describe circumstances that made it more likely, you know, post-war economic teenage blah blah stuff, but in the end, that's quite magical. But I think the particular feature of their relationship, the creative relationship, is that they were precisely equal. I mean, I always write about Paul McCartney because he was the one I got to meet and he was the one who lived when I was doing my career. But, you know, I wish I'd met John Lennon. He was killed just as I got going, and I never did John Lennon. I'm sure I would have done. But I'm not a kind of Paul guy as opposed to being a John guy. I think in their time together with the Beatles, their talents and their energies were precisely equal. These two countervailing forces, neither could topple over the other. They produced this dialectic, I suppose, is the intellectual word. There was something so equal that it could only produce a third thing. You know, element one could not overpower element two. They had to produce element three. And that was the extraordinary thing that resulted.
What do you think, Laura?
I think something quite similar, really. But whenever I think about what makes a good partnership, whether that's creative or romantic or anything like that, I think about something that Tom Waits said about Kathleen Brennan, who's obviously both creative and romantic partner. And after this big spiel about all these amazing attributes that she has, he says, "That's who you want to go into the woods with. Someone who finishes your sentences for you." And I kind of think that's the same thing with them. If you look at a lot of the songs they wrote together, whether that's Day in the Life or She's Leaving Home, for example, it feels as if they're finishing each other's sentences. Or even if you look at Strawberry Fields followed by Penny Lane, it's a constant dialogue between the two of them.
What about you?
They both came from the same background. Paul makes a really good point in the book about that when John...
Absolutely identical. I mean, yeah, Paul really likes to play this up. I was the working class guy and John was the posho middle... The differences were tiny, you know.
No, they're tiny, but I mean, also the same musical backgrounds. That John
absolutely
really
identical,
loved.
Yeah.
He loved old sort of ballads and show tunes from the 1930s. We kind of think of him as being somebody who just was invented by Eddie Cochran or whatever, you know. Yeah. And so it's interesting they come from the same backgrounds, but they have a completely different approach. And McCartney writes these, I suppose you could describe as vertical songs, huge, great, massive octave leaps like Penny Lane. And John Lennon writes very horizontal songs, you know, built within a very constrained number of notes because his vocal range wasn't as big. And the main difference is just their approach. McCartney, this extraordinary optimism, and Lennon, it's not pessimism, it's a kind of realism and an element of self-doubt and an element of kind of paranoia. And I think when they're together, and there's a brilliant example of this actually on We Can Work It Out, which was written by the two of them in separate sections. McCartney writes that wonderful bit about, you know... We can work it out, you know, the relationship, you know, how are we going to make this work? And Lennon writes that wonderful, life is very short and there's no time. This forlorn little kind of intersection with a harmonium. And in fact, George Harrison wrote the waltz at the end, so it was a real collaborative effort. But I think it's really interesting that effect, obviously, working together, it must have influenced the other, even if it wasn't direct. And the reason for that, I think, my theory is that the overall impression of the Beatles that you get is one of enormous joy and optimism. They were never self-pitiful. They were never forlorn. These songs are absolutely rammed with a sense of just jubilation. And your mental image of them is in primary colours of red and yellow of Sgt. Pepper. And I think the main architect of that probably was McCartney. And when the group finished, McCartney carried on making songs that still seemed to be direct derivatives of the Beatles, I felt. And Lennon, I felt, without that around him, his songs seemed so sour and so forlorn and so savage and cynical. And I felt, obviously, they'd produced different songs within the context of the Beatles. But with outside of the Beatles, he seemed a very different entity. One that I actually personally didn't like very much. I don't really like his solo material at all. I'm ashamed to admit that, but it's true.
I like
so I thought that was a major difference.
But Paul McCartney's epitaph, I think, you know, I'm not wishing it to be soon, but I was thinking of this line from Arnold Bennett thing, you know, the card, that book Arnold Bennett wrote and it was, became a film with Alec Guinness. In fact, I should have put it in the book. I don't know why I didn't, but the card is this Jack the Lad character who makes fortune after fortune. And at the end, someone says, what was he all about? And the final line is, he identified with the great cause of cheering us all up. And that is Paul McCartney, you know.
Which journalists will never give sufficient credit for.
The journalists as a breed don't. I mean, Danny Baker is an obvious exception to this, yeah. But journalists as a breed tend to admire the Velvet Underground more than the Beach Boys, maybe, yes. Or, you know.
They admire miserable people because yeah. They can entirely identify with them, you know. Because the greatest thing the greatest thing you can say about a pop song is it's catchy. And that you don't fill a thousand words with that, do you?
What about Eleanor Rigby? That was a Paul song, wasn't it?
Yes.
But yeah, and she's leaving home.
Yes.
He was
completely capable of exactly the same kind of thing, but Lennon ultimately wins. People think that that's the strong message.
They think that's true.
Yeah.
This is one of the things that Peter Dogger was talking yeah. about on the podcast recently. Just throw in my little... fourpenneth on the relationship between the two of them. I think the genius of the Beatles was they had no patience whatsoever. They wanted to do it. They wanted to do it straight away, whatever it was. And they did brilliant things really quickly. Later on, when they had loads of time and loads of drugs, they started slowing down. And the longer the tracks were, the worse they were. Yes? Which you wouldn't have gotten away with that in the early days. You know what I mean? And so they just packed in stuff at every stage. You listen to those early records and they've got, you know, 50% more catchiness than any other group would have had. You know, the first bit that they wrote would have been enough for most groups. It wasn't enough for them. They thought, no, you've got to put something extra in there as well. And that, you know, that came between the cooperation and the competition between the two of them. Now we've also asked everybody to talk about their favourite post-Beatles, Paul McCartney. And I think this is yours, Mark.
Well, it is, yeah. I was just going to mention a couple of other songs, actually. I was going to mention the Farman records, which are really good, I think. I don't know if anyone's ever heard those. They're the records he made with Youth, under a pseudonym, really. People didn't know who it was at first. But they're really fascinating because they're electronic experiments with cut-up lyrics. But even in that context, he still cannot possibly produce songs without extraordinary melodies. It's really, really interesting and fascinating. There's a couple of songs on the record that came out called New, which is... when did that come out? About 2 years ago, is it?
Yeah, it's his most recent studio album. Yeah.
Save Us and On My Way Home. On My Way Home, I just wrote down these lyrics actually on the paper coming in because they're so funny. It's about him being on a green bus when he was a kid. And he says, sorry, it's called On My Way to Work. It says, on my way to work, I bought a magazine. Inside, a pretty girl who liked to water ski. She came from Chichester to study history. She had removed her clothes for the likes of me. It's just a brilliant lyric. It's so clever. So sweet. It's just him going back to what he was like when he was 14 on a Liverpool bus, you know. But the songs that I really love it. I love this Ram Up. I know you're very keen on it too, Paul. It's an amazing record. I'm sure I have some support from the floor here for this terrific record. Yes. And I think everything about it is just extraordinary. The melodies are absolutely astonishing. There are some of the greatest melodies he ever wrote. The arrangements, again, the sense of complete exhilaration, complete jubilation. Brilliant songs. There's one called Monkbury Moon Delight, which I learned from your book, actually. It was published in his book of poetry, which is so wonderful.
The choice of the songs he chose as being worthy of recital as poetry. Not in a pompous way, but I suppose just because he wanted to draw people's attention. But I think he must have just enjoyed writing Monkbury Moon Delight so much, and the lyric pleases him because it reminds him of that pleasure that he took, you know, Another one was, why don't we do it on the road?
A horrible sound of tomato, he says at one point.
Yeah, well, Ram is, I think it's also, of all the solo things, it's probably the one album I would play completely. I mean, I like lots of his solo stuff, but it doesn't always work in units of albums. This one really does.
It's often people say, oh, it was received very badly at the time because it got some unkind reviews, but they weren't all bad at all. The thing that I only realised recently was that Uncle Albert, Admiral Halsey, was number one in the United States, wasn't it? Number one single. And everybody tends to think, you know, that this record just came and disappeared. It didn't at all, you know. It was never fashionable. That's the important difference, isn't it? So that's
well,
your
a lot
choice.
Of its problem was that Lennon lampooned it very cruelly, didn't he? That photograph
absolutely.
Of him holding the ears of a pig.
Yeah. Yeah. I just wanted to... I love this record.
It's topical, of course, talking about pigs, but we're moving on.
I just...
I had this discussion off air.
It's only when I was looking at the cover this morning, you can't see this, it's very blurred. One thing everybody agreed about when this record came out was that Maybe I'm Amazed was a brilliant song. It's next to the last track. It's chucked in there next to the last track. This was the most deliberately uncommercial move he could possibly make, wasn't it? You know, I've got to put out a record, and I've got a really nice picture of me with the baby, but that's going to go on the back. I'm going to have some cherries on the front. You know what
because
I mean?
It was taken by his wife, of course.
Absolutely.
Both were, so there we go.
But there's still something I like about that record, that absolute rawness, you know, it was a complete antidote to the Beatles at the time because they'd started putting track and track on top of each other, and that was very different. So that's probably my favourite, although I like Ram too. Laura, you chose Red Rose Speedway.
Yeah, I'm not really sure. Well,
still
I am.
Haunted by the cover?
I think I do feel quite terrified now I'm looking at it. I mean, Ram probably, but I like the continuation of some of the material from the Ram sessions on here. And in a similar way, just I like the sort of liberated McCartney. I like him away from the Beatles. I like him. I prefer the live version of Maybe I'm Amazed, to be honest, not the album version. And I even like him when he's singing with Stevie Wonder, and I like him when he's singing with Michael Jackson. I like the fact that he just took the gloves off and just said, I'm going to do everything as soon
right.
as he. Yeah.
So you don't fall out with his corniness at all?
I don't, because I grew up in the 80s, probably, so I had right. no real concept of corniness. Everything was just great.
Right.
So, no. I mean, I suppose I find him cornier now and cheesier now, and I find the hair dye and things that
he
era much...
He doesn't dye his hair, does he?
Paul, does he?
I couldn't possibly say. No, he does, but I always cut him a lot of... I cut him some slack because he's in show business. And he's never denied he's in show business.
Yeah, yeah.
You go to a stadium, you know, a big arena, Enormo Dome, from 3 miles away, you see this figure on stage, and he's kept his figure. Let's you know,
he's got the military jacket on. He's got the Hofner base.
He's got the Hofner base. Yeah. He's got the mop top. He didn't go bald. From 3 miles away, you are seeing Beetle Paul. Yeah. This is the experience you've grown up craving. And he just goes that one, you know, he goes that extra mile to give people that Beetle Paul experience.
He is so faithful to the legacy of the Beatles, isn't he?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
He's never denied it at all, has he? Whereas John Lennon denied it like crazy.
But that might be my sort of slight issue with him now, because the one that I first encountered was so not that person. He's sort of gone back to being that person in a bit of sort of a Madame Tussauds way that I find a bit... unsettling.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, sorry.
So those are our choices of post-Beatles McCartney stuff. What's the best McCartney song?
I love this game. Again, I know the answer, so it's, I feel
well,
very confident.
Well, I do know.
Oh, yeah. I've
got it written down here. Let's see if you can guess it, Laura.
Is this like the quiz all over again, where Mark claims to know the answer?
Yeah, Mark will get up at the end and go, I know, and we'll all lose. We'll all go home empty-handed. Go on, Laura.
Can
favorite Paul McCartney Beatles song?
I'm going to say either... Can I say She's Leaving Home? Can I say... I mean, I realise I wrote them together. She's Leaving Home and A Day in Life are my two favourites.
Right.
But also... re-listening, you know, listen to the obvious ones, listen to Hey Jude. My favourite McCartney moments are when he's tender. We talked about him being bright and poppy and whatever, and actually I think of him as quite tender and wistful, and those are my favourite moments, like Eleanor Rigby as well. He's not the obvious McCartney in those moments to me.
Right. What about you, Paul?
The official best Paul McCartney song with the Beatles. Well, I've got about 12, because they change from day to day, and that's the...
Runners up.
Oh, well, runners up. Okay. Any that Laura's just mentioned would. Again, I don't know whether you want to mention this, but I'm Down, the B side of.
Oh God, that's yours.
Okay, sorry.
I won't do this.
I won't do this. I'll just go straight to the top then. The official best song, Paul song with the Beatles is "You Never Give Me Your Money," and here's here's the reason. McCartney is one of the least autobiographical writers in rock music, certainly when you contrast him with John Lennon. But as he himself says, that whatever he sits down and writes, when he looks back at it, and when people like me talk to him about it, he suddenly cottons on that it was actually autobiographical. There was lots of stuff in there that he didn't intend to be self-revelatory. It just kind of came through. And he was saying to me, oh God, you know, Paul is just mad, man, you know, because this fella comes up to America and says, that song, you know, You Never Give Me Your Money, that's just so deep, isn't it? You know, he says, well, I thought it was a nice song, you know, but no, come on, you know, Nowhere to Go, that's like really deep, isn't it? And McCartney said, if you think so, that's great. Because he had no idea what any of it was about. And I said, well, surely, at least the first bit, everyone says that's about the Apple dissolution, you know, You Never Give Me Money. He said, yeah, probably, yeah, actually it was about Alan Klein. And it turns out the whole song is completely literally autobiographical. This thing, I never give you my pillow, I only send you my invitations. Alan Klein, who was his arch tormentor at that, this is March 1969, Alan Klein kept saying to the Beatles, Paul, he's the reluctant virgin. He wants to get you into bed and then he won't. He says he wants you in bed, then he won't. I never give him a pillow. And he said to me, that's what the whole thing is all about. It only occurred to me at the weekend, actually. It's not even in the book, but he talks about it. He talks about the background in the book, and then it's three sections. The book is the film is this. The song has these perfect three sections. This very mournful, all the woes of Apple. I break down, and he's literally breaking down. It's the saddest time of his entire life to that point. He is physically and emotionally breaking down when he goes home to St. John's Wood, with the sheer trauma of the Beatles' breakup. But at the same time, he's just got together with Linda. Then the middle section is he kind of retrieves this memory of childhood, of leaving school. His career has gone nowhere. He should have been a teacher, but he's left before his A-levels. And he takes a job as a van driver's assistant. His life has been a complete failure. Little does he know that he's about to join the band he's just joined is about to become the biggest phenomenon in history. As far as he's concerned, he's 16 and he's completely fucked up his life. Yeah. He's left the Liverpool Institute, this passport to future prosperity. He's left. He doesn't know what the hell he's done. But he's got nowhere to go. But at the same time, it's kind of exciting. You know, this for the first time, there are no plans, there are no homework schedules to follow. Then the final thing is the tempo picks up even further. The key changes for the third time, and One Sweet Dream came true today. He's got Linda now. They drive off into the country. The big thing is they take the phone off the hook. They refuse to go into any more meetings with Apple. They just drive off into the country. They don't know where they're heading, and that's their escape from the madness and the heartbreak.
That's a very eloquent argument for You Never Give Me Your Money.
Which is the wrong answer, obviously.
The answer is, obviously, I'm Down. I'm Down because it's not what people expect. It's the B-side of Help, for crying out loud. You know, they could throw gems away like that on B-sides. And he did I'm Down on the same day as he did I Just Seen a Face and Yesterday. And I've decided I hate Yesterday. Can I say this? You know,
Yes, it is a kind of all right song that became a huge deal because, you know, ballad singers could sing it. You know, and in the mid-60s, everybody agreed the Beatles were a good thing. But, you know, so Ella Fitzgerald would waltz in there and do the most appalling version of Can't Buy Me Love, you know, which makes me ill just to think about it still. And Ella Fitzgerald's a great artist, but he had no business doing Can't Buy Me Love or whatever. And whereas Yesterday was slow enough that Frank Sinatra and all these other people could sing it, but it's dull as ditch water, isn't it?
Well, I wouldn't say it's dull as ditch water, but I mean, he's got other stuff, Dave, you know.
He has got other stuff, but I'm just saying it's overrated anyway. So the answer is I'm down. So now you can say what you think.
I just add one thing to I'm down, which I thought was so brilliant, which is that McCartney's ability to manipulate, particularly the women in his audience. There's a line in I'm Down which goes, "Man buys ring, woman throws it away. Same old thing happened every day," which is just a genius line. And, you know, with three elder sisters, I was very aware of the lure of McCartney, you know. And there are girls sitting there thinking, he buys rings and gives them to women and they don't want him. But, you know, Paul, for God's sake, me! You know, brilliant, brilliant manipulation of the audience. Where Lennon was writing these incredibly kind of self-interested and inward-looking songs. I can remember hearing, age 12, a Lennon song that started with the words, "She said, I know what it's like to be dead," and thinking that's quite a contrast to McCartney. But the answer to your question is, apart from I'm Down, obviously, and I Will, and Helter Skelter, and She's Leaving Home, I would say it's Penny Lane. And I say very briefly why about Penny Lane. Penny Lane is just a phenomenal piece of songwriting. There's a picture of it. It's just extraordinary. It's, you know, it's a memory of his childhood at the same time as John was thinking about going back to Strawberry Field when he was a child. And he goes back to the area around the bus station, Penny Lane, and it's like a piece of, it's like a documentary, actually. It's like a piece of cinema, or it's like a piece of journalism. So he runs the camera across the street, and you see the banker, you see the fireman, you know, you see all these characters, the barber, and then you hear beneath the blue suburban skies. And he talks about it being, it's in my ears and in my eyes. So it's this whole idea of sense impression. And then you hear the soundtrack. As he goes down, you hear the clanging of the fire bells as he goes past. And you hear the little piccolo trumpet as if it was a street vendor. It's absolutely extraordinary. And then just to put the tin lid on it, he manages to get all three characters, the fireman, the barber, and the banker, to meet up in the same room, in the third row, for no reason at all. It's a perfect, circular, brilliant song with an incredible melody and arrangement. And I think it's fantastic.
Well, it's sad.
And that's the right answer. So there we go. So I hope you've enjoyed it. And, oh, there's more.
It's sad that it can only come second. So there's huge amounts of mythology sprouting around Paul McCartney's head, you know. What's your favourite Paul McCartney story, Laura?
I had heard this story and then I looked it up on this thing called the internet earlier, and apparently it is an actual story and not just a drunken friend telling me that Paul McCartney can whistle in Burlington Arcade. Is that true?
Well, he's allowed.
I'm looking at you like you know. Is that true, Paul?
Well, by special dispensation, can he?
Well, it's like members of the royal family can kill a swan in a royal park.
But
it's one of those weird laws. McCartney's allowed to whistle in Burlington Arcade.
Apparently, you're not allowed to whistle in Burlington Arcade.
Unless you're McCartney.
Unless you're Paul McCartney.
Very good.
Yeah.
It's a heck of a distinction. Yes. Paul.
Superb.
Can I do two quick stories?
Of course you can.
Both in the book, actually. When he was the Beatles were big mates with the Bonzo Dog band around 67, 68 time, and the Bonzos were struggling a bit, and of course they they asked him would he come in and play the ukulele on a song they were doing called Urban Spaceman. He said, "No, I'll come in. Actually, I'll produce it for you." And he came in, and the Bonzos were a struggling bunch of, you know, obscure old art school weirdos, really, at this stage. But Paul McCartney comes in with a big old sack of furry dust and gives them the only top five record in the entire career. And I was talking to Neil Innes, and he was saying it was just astonishing the star power that McCartney had, because we were in there, the manager had booked us maybe 60 minutes of studio time, but McCartney comes in and says, and everyone kind of writes off the day, and Viv Stanchel says, "I want to put my a trumpet mouthpiece inside a garden hose and swing it round my head. You know, that da-da-da-da-da thing that's in the... And the engineers are saying, no, we can't do that, mate, sorry. And McCartney says, that's a really good idea. And at that point, he gets them to refit, fit out the entire studio so that there is now a microphone in every corner of the room to pick up the nozzle, the sprinkler on the end of Viv Stanchel's garden hose, which is all part of the making of this fabulous hit record. But McCartney could do that, you know. And in the end, the record wasn't quite finished. They needed another day. But in those days, you couldn't just ring McCartney up and say, sorry, Paul, we need you back for another day. They had to. They called in a new engineer, a young guy called Gus Studgeon, who finished off the record. Gus Studgeon went on to have this trilogy of big hits, all of them extraterrestrial. There was the Urban Spaceman. Next song he does is Space Oddity by David Bowie. And the next one is Rocket Man by Elton John. That was the short story. Yes. Have you got time for the long ones?
What about you?
It's not remotely funny, actually. It's just something that really fascinates me. It's really the making of the Ballad of John and Yoko. And I think it's interesting because when this record was made, I would imagine that it was the absolute low point of the internal relations of the members of the group. Two of the members of the group were abroad. One had effectively left the group. And John Lennon came back with this idea of a song, rang up Paul McCartney and said, and you know, they were arguing about Alan Klein. They were in a miserable state of disarray, incredible personal enmity. But he rang him up and said, I've written a song about my life outside the group with Yoko Ono, who I would imagine would have been one of the reasons for some of that tension anyway, and I want to put it out under the Beatles' name on the Beatles label. It's a Beatles record. And I want to make it. I want to make it now. And he went round to McCartney's house and he played it to him. McCartney heard the song. They went straight to Abbey Road and recorded it in 4 hours. And McCartney and John Lennon played the acoustic guitar and McCartney played the drums. And then he dubbed on the bass part, the piano part, the percussion part, and sang the backing vocal. And John Lennon did the two guitars. They finished the whole thing in 4 hours. And what I thought was extraordinary about it was just... It made you realise, made me realise anyway, that what they had between them, that unbelievable alchemical relationship that could produce anything they touched turned to gold, was so extraordinary and so heightened and so rare and so valued by themselves too and so appreciated that they would override even these dreadful situations that had happened between them to help each other out. And I thought it was really touching. It was fascinating.
My favourite apocryphal Paul McCartney story, sadly, you know, it ran for about 10 years and then we found out it wasn't true, was that he was breeding a special load of chickens up in the Mullican Tyre and he had them flown in from overseas and picked up in a cab at Heathrow and taken chickens all the way up to the Mullican Tyre. And so surprise drivers on the M6 were passed by a London cab full of chickens. Going all the... But, you know, I picked this picture because... I don't know if anybody's ever sat in the Pizza Express on Dean Street in Soho, which is round the corner from McCartney's office. And he is occasionally seen, you know, making his way around Soho. And I was once in there, and, you know, and it's big windows either side on the corner, and it was lunchtime. And he went past with a small child on his shoulder, so I don't know, one of his own or whatever, I don't know. And the whole restaurant just kind of went like that. And he waved back all the way around. And I think it's a really important point because there's only two people I've ever seen do that. Because the other occasion was not long afterwards. I was standing by the Mall near Buckingham Palace one summer's evening when up came with the Royal Standard, the large limousine containing the Queen. I'm standing there on my own at the side of the Mall. This thing's going past slowly. She goes... And I go, you know, like...
Because David Hepworth waved at me.
No, that's a serious point, because I thought they're both people who understand their symbolic function. Completely. Paul McCartney knows he has to do that kind of stuff. And he's never shrunk from it at all, has he? You know, that he knows that
He's different from most people.
That's how the thumbs up thing developed. He always has to acknowledge people. He can't ignore anybody ever. And the thumbs up was a very economic way of doing that quickly to a whole crowd of people.
Yeah, while keeping moving, because never stop.
While keeping moving, yeah.
And if he was in Burlington Arcade, he'd whistle for you as well, because we now know.
So, you know, please make a point of making a booking at the Pizza Express on Dean Street, where he guarantees to see Paul McCartney. Absolutely.
Can I just plug this book one more
time? Every lunchtime.
It's just so good. There are copies available. It's absolutely tremendous. I learned so much about McCartney, and I know a great deal already. It's just a riveting read, and I know Paul will be very pleased to sign copies of it.
Absolutely.
Certainly, absolutely, yes.
So thanks so much for
coming. Thank you very much to both our guests.
Thank you, Laura. Thank you to Paul.
And Paul Denoyer.
Thank you to David, and thank you very much for coming along. Terrific. See you again.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.